How did one of the world's most famous atheists become one of its most famous Christians? Find out in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis. It's written by regular guest Dr. Joel Heck. From Atheism to Christianity is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. From Atheism to Christianity. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It is a fascinating story. It's a long story, in fact, from atheism to Christianity. It's not a story that's uncommon, but when you tell it with the name C.S. Lewis attached to it, it takes on a little kind of broader scope, and it certainly does for Lewis. He's a man who had marshaled all of his intellectual abilities against the belief in God. He was not a casual atheist, but one that was, let's call him a deliberate atheist. And being one, it probably breaking the shell of that intellect and of that conviction took some time. And in his case, at least by his accounting, it took 15 years, his journey from atheism to Christianity. We're going to continue telling that story on this Wednesday afternoon, May the 24th. Part two of our three-part series on C.S. Lewis today, Lewis's conversion to Christianity. Oddly enough, he remembers it at beginning with a work of literature. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest, professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, visiting professor at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Canada, and author of The Issues Etc., Book of the Month, From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis. Dr. Heck, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back once more.
Why did this phase of C.S. Lewis's life here, why did it take, by his account, 15 years?
That's a good question. Partly because he was such a thoughtful person, at times a very, very deep thinker, and perhaps because he had gotten in so deeply with his atheism and agnosticism that it simply took that long for him to work through all of the objections that he had.
So we're talking about a guy, I said a moment ago, a deliberate atheist. He marshaled his considerable intellectual and scholarly abilities in service of this for some time, didn't he?
Yes, he did. His letters indicate that. He later on regrets having embarrassed himself by making fun of his childhood friend Arthur Greaves and thinking him naive or unsophisticated to buy into the basic Christian message. Later on regretted it, but at the time he was the swashbuckling atheist, a hardcore advocate of his atheistic position.
Lewis uses several metaphors to talk about the conversion, but all of them have something in common, you point out, and that is God pursuing him. Why is that so important for Lewis?
Yes, there were three different metaphors, the chess game, the fisherman, and the fox hunt. Yeah, God is pursuing him. He once had an interview, was interviewed by Sherwood Wirt, the editor of Decision Magazine, you know, the publication of the Billy Graham Organization. And Sherwood Wirt was trying to get him to say when he decided to become a believer in Jesus Christ. And Sherwood Wirt was an honest man. They ended up publishing a two-article series entitled, I Was Decided Upon. In other words, it was God that was pursuing him rather than the other way around. He was actually going in the opposite direction. He was hoping that this Christian message wasn't true. He's running in the opposite direction. So if he's going to get caught, it was going to have to be God doing it, because it certainly wasn't going to happen because Lewis was, let's say, as Sigmund Freud suggests of a lot of Christians, that Lewis was guilty of wishful thinking. Certainly not. Now, there's even an imaginative passage in one of the Chronicles of Narnia where I believe it's Edmund, one of the four Pevensey children, is asked, do you know Aslan? And Edmund says, well, he knows me. So for Lewis, it was very much the other way around, and it was one of those things that Lutheran theology holds up as really, really important, this objective justification. God is the actor, and we are the ones acted upon. He calls the shots. He's the creator. He's the redeemer. He's the sanctifier. So I think Lewis had a theology that very much agreed with the biblical theology that sees that the scripture is really about God and about his son, the Messiah, Jesus Christ, rather than about us.
You begin the story talking about the beginning of the First World War in early summer of 1914, and Lewis decides he wants to kind of put the violence surrounding him out of his mind, and he kind of isolates himself a little intellectually, but he takes up George MacDonald's book. What book does he credit with kind of the beginning of the melting of the ice?
Yes, it's a book called Phantastes, which is a Greek word for fantasies. It's an imaginative piece of writing about a parallel world that a character by the name of Anidas experiences. Anidas is Greek for ascent, or it could also be translated somebody who has lost his way. At any rate, Anidas has these travels through this imaginary world and trees that have spirits within them and palaces with nobody living in them but some sort of a presence, and some trees that are good, some that are evil, and there are dangers, there are joys, and he experiences both of them. And that sort of awakened his imagination significantly, even though this is 1916, and when he came back from the war, he did serve in the First World War for a few months. He was injured and ended up spending most of his recuperation time in a hospital, and so was spared some of the ravages of the war. But when he came back from the war, he wanted to live this life of a consistent materialist. He uses the phrase, I think it's in his autobiography, that he wanted to believe in atoms and evolution and military service, and that was about it. But so these glimpses from George MacDonald's book of an imaginary world, a seemingly parallel world that has some significance to it. He saw a little bit of that in the poetry of William Butler Yeats. Those were a bit disconcerting to him, and so when he comes back from the war, he's going to try to live very, very consistently with his five senses and not believe in any of these spiritual concepts or imaginative concepts that aren't totally consistent with materialism, and that's what he has a great deal of trouble with over the next half a dozen years especially.
So his materialist faith is beginning to be shaken a little bit after having read this book by MacDonald. What comes next?
Well, there are a lot of things that are happening. I mean, I like the fact that it's a 15-year journey because he's checking out a lot of different things. He's dabbling in the occult a little bit, partly because of the poet Yeats. He's reading literary classics. He's got a couple of friends who leave behind materialism for an unusual approach to life or philosophy called anthroposophy. They were materialists. They adopt this, which is essentially a spiritual or supernatural view of the world. There is a parallel world. That shakes him up. He starts, he's studying some philosophy and attracted by some of it. He's applying for jobs. He's dealing with the guilt of a relationship to a woman he's not married to. And he eventually becomes, and this is not totally certain, but he becomes an idealist, not in the sense that we would think of it today. I mean, an idealist is good, usually somebody young who has a view of what he wants to do in life or what the world ought to be and wants to live up to these ideals. But in the 1920s in Oxford, idealism was a very specific philosophical system that is perhaps best exemplified by the Anglican clergyman George Berkeley, who lived a couple of centuries prior to Lewis's day, who was a famous idealist, and there are several British idealists as well. So he's being drawn to this philosophy, which has sort of a vague, impersonal, divine figure almost, that they call the Absolute. That's the sum of all existence. The Absolute is something like a mind, but it's impersonal, and therefore it's not a deity that's personal that would actually expect anything or demand anything or hold you accountable for anything, or who loves you in any sort of a personal way. So he liked idealism that he later on described as having all the conveniences of theism, but without actually holding to a belief in God. And that was nice for him. It's helpful, but it's not too personal. And so he adopts idealism probably in 1924. He gets his first full-time teaching position in 1925. And he's actually teaching a little bit of philosophy, mostly English literature, but a little bit of philosophy. And he deals with the problem that you can't really teach idealism and make it clear to students unless you have a clear idea of what you're talking about. And he finds idealism a little bit frustrating as a result. And he achieves a certain amount of dissatisfaction with idealism, which is helping him head towards theism and Christianity.
Well, let's take a break right there, Dr. Heck. We'll pick up the story on the other side. It's part two of our three-part series on C.S. Lewis today, Lewis's conversion to Christianity, a very long road, and we're tracking it with Dr. Joel Heck, author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month, From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis. After our conversation with Dr. Joel Heck on the other side concludes, Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine will join us to talk about liberalism and free speech.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're telling the story of C.S. Lewis's conversion to Christianity. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest on this Wednesday afternoon, May the 24th, part two of our series on C.S. Lewis. When you left off, Dr. Heck, we find C.S. Lewis attempting to teach this philosophy of idealism, but a bit frustrated with that system of thought. Pick it up there.
Yes, and so he's trying to deal with that. He doesn't really figure out that he's using idealism as a way of keeping God at arm's length until several years later. But one of the things, a year after this, after he becomes a fellow, which was 1925. In 1926, he has a late-night conversation with an atheist philosopher by the name of Harry Weldon, who's teaching at the same college. He's a bachelor living at Magdalen College, just like Lewis is. And they are discussing the historical nature of the Gospels. And Weldon surprises Lewis a great deal here. He thinks that the evidence for the resurrection is actually surprisingly strong. And he makes a comment about this. And Lewis, prior to this time, had bought into the higher critical understanding of the New Testament that says that the Gospels contain a lot of legendary material. You can't really be confident that the historical Jesus is really portrayed there because people embellished the stories and wrote decades, if not centuries, after the events. And so Weldon makes this comment. He says, all that stuff about Fraser's dying God, it almost looks as if it had really happened once. In other words, he's admitting that the evidence in the Gospels for the resurrection of Jesus is surprisingly strong. And then Lewis writes, to understand the shattering impact of it, you would need to know the man who has certainly never since shown any interest in Christianity. If he, the cynic of cynics, the toughest of the toughs, were not, as I would have put it, safe, where could I turn? Was there then no escape? So this comment from Harry Weldon causes Lewis to reevaluate the Gospels, eventually shifts away from this higher critical understanding of the New Testament Gospels and sees them, especially the Gospel of John, becomes his favorite. He sees them as reliable historical records. And that helps to set the stage for his adoption of theism in 1930 and his becoming a Christian in 1931. There's a lot more that happens, but probably between 1926 and 1930, the single most important thing that happens is the death of his father.
Now, this he classifies that as, in that chess analogy, as what loss of at least one of his bishops, so to speak, doesn't he?
The two bishops were lost in 1924. The loss, the check and checkmate came in 1930, as I read it. He doesn't specifically date those events, but he describes them, and we're able to piece things together by looking at his letters and his diaries and some other historical documents. But the check move that God put on him, I think, happened in February of 1930, when Lewis realized that his love of romantic literature, George MacDonald's Fantasties, some of the great poetry that he had read, that all of that, what he called joy or longing, which was really longing for God or for the supernatural, he connected that to the absolute, this mind behind the universe in the philosophy of idealism. And a few months later in June, he realizes that the absolute is really just another name for God, and he admits that he's been using that philosophy to keep God at a distance, and admits that God is God, probably in the first 6 days of June 1930. But the death of his father helped to awaken his conscience. I think of it as a law-gospel moment for Lewis. So his father died in September 1929, and Lewis comes to realize that the absolute of idealism is the object of his longing. That's that February 1930 idea. But that's set up by an awareness of how poorly he had treated his father, and he later on writes that he doesn't think there's any sin so great that he ever committed that was as bad as this one. After the death of his mother, when Lewis was 9 and his older brother Warren is just 2.5 years older than he, the father kind of alienated the sons unintentionally, and both Warren and Jack drew closer to one another and further away from their father, had arguments with him, spoke in derogatory fashion about him and even to his face at times, and referred it to him by several derogatory terms like the old airbag that they abbreviated OAB. But in 1929, Lewis's father gets cancer. He dies in September, and for about 5 weeks leading up to that, C.S. Lewis is trying to take care of his father and sort of repay a debt, but he doesn't know how to apologize. He's clearly not a Christian. He doesn't understand grace and forgiveness, and he's trying somehow to make up for his sins, and it's just really not working for him. But he does spend 5 weeks doing everything he possibly can for his father. Then he heads back to Oxford in order to begin the fall semester teaching at Oxford University. 2 days after he leaves, his father dies. He gets telegrams saying that. He heads back to Belfast to arrange for the funeral and to begin the disposition of the estate. So he's got this huge unpaid debt weighing on his conscience. He eventually realizes that Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God, can relieve for him, but he's trying to deal with it in the fall months and beginning in the first month of 1930, and realizes that maybe God's trying to get a message to him. And on February 3, 1930, he writes a letter to his friend Owen Barfield and says, "You better come quickly, because if you don't arrive here by Monday, I might have entered a monastery." So he's having all these religious thoughts, and he's beginning to remember some of the things that he learned in childhood in Belfast as a church attender, even though it was fairly formal and sterile. And he's beginning to realize that the fundamental Christian message of grace and forgiveness is the solution to his problem. So that's the third of the four chess moves, probably February 3, 1930. And then he continues to think about this and to do his work and feel that God is approaching him, trying to close in on him. He feels like a fox that's trying to run away from the dogs and the hunters, and he's been flushed from what he calls the Hegelian woods. G.W.F. Hegel was an idealist from Germany and was one of the thinkers that helped to develop idealism to what it was in the Oxford in the 1920s. He's trying to escape from Hegel's idealism, and finally then in 1930, he admits that God is God and writes that classic passage in his autobiography. I've got it in front of me if you want me to read it.
Sure.
It's one of the most frequently quoted passages in all of Lewis, and it's in a chapter in his autobiography called Checkmate. So he says, "You must picture me alone in that room in Maudlin, night after night, feeling, whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet, that which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, it was really 1930, but he didn't realize it when he wrote this, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England." And by that statement, the way he's describing his conversion to theism, not to Christianity at this point, but to theism, I think he's trying to repudiate the suggestion of Sigmund Freud that people only believe in God because they wish there were a God. They have a father who was imperfect, and they have a desire for a much better father, a perfect father, and so they project this idea and force themselves or cause themselves to believe in the existence of God, and that's why they're theists. And Lewis is making it very clear. He wasn't wishing that God did exist. He was actually wishing that he didn't and that he wouldn't be pursuing him. And so that's why he calls himself the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England.
So is that Checkmate at that point?
That's Checkmate, yes. The conversion to theism is Checkmate, not the conversion to Christianity. We'd probably see it that way from our theological perspective. But for Lewis, the admission that there is a God and that he's accountable to him is the Checkmate move.
So he's a theist at this point. He, as you say, he is remembering the his childhood faith, which was, as you said, something more than nominal Christianity, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, the early years were largely nominal, but there was a period of time when he was attending a school called Cherbourg House, just outside of Malvern, England, that he attended church regularly. He discussed Christian doctrines. He seriously believed them and tried to live according to them. And so he was a sincerely practicing Christian at that point, but it was probably not with a solid foundation. And during the second half of that two-year period is when he adopted atheism, partly in reaction to his mother's death, partly because of his struggles with schools that didn't seem to understand such a bright and precocious young man, partly because he was awkward in sports, and it was very much a sportsy kind of school that he had some difficulty participating in. So there are all these problems that he's got, plus he's trying to pray, and his prayers seem to go unanswered, and so he comes to the conclusion. He says in a letter to his brother at one point that all of these requests to God, either you come to the conclusion that God does not exist or you've got his address wrong. And so that's the unanswered prayers, or at least what he saw as unanswered prayers, was another one of the reasons why he adopted atheism so many years before.
When does it go from, we'll get started here before the break, if you would, from theism to Christianity? How does that begin with just a minute or so before we take our break?
Yes, this is September 1931. There's a lot more that's going on. He's known J.R. Tolkien for several years by this time, and he and Tolkien have a conversation at from midnight to 3 a.m. There's another friend that's involved in the conversation. Tolkien convinces him that myth is able to convey powerful truth, that the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus is a myth, not in the sense that it didn't happen, but in the sense that it contains this pattern of a dying and rising God, and so that the Gospels can contain the myth of the death and resurrection of Christ, with the exception that, unlike the other myths, this one actually happened in history. And so it's on September 28, 1931, that Lewis, in light of that conversation that happened just 9 days earlier, he's riding with his brother to the zoo in the sidecar of his brother's motorcycle, and he doesn't give us the specifics of it. All he does is to say when he started on the trip to the zoo, he did not believe that Jesus was the Son of God, and when they reached the zoo, he did believe it. And so that's the day, the hour when he became a Christian, September 28, 1931.
We'll talk about the aftermath of that with Dr. Joel Heck. It's part two of our three-part series on C.S. Lewis today. Lewis's conversion to Christianity. Dr. Joel Heck has written the book, From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis. You can browse before you buy right there at our website, issuesetc.org. It's on every page of the website. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House and order From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis by Dr. Joel Heck. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Stay tuned.
I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Theology for blue collar, white collar, and clerical collar. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the CLCC.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a confessional Lutheran. TheCLCC.org.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're telling the story of C.S. Lewis in a three-part series today. Part two, Lewis's conversion to Christianity. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. Dr. Heck, you write this about C.S. Lewis. You say, if anything is true of Lewis, it is this. C.S. Lewis honestly grappled with the truth. We've been telling the story about this honest grappling with the truth during his times of atheism and theism, and then, as you said, moving, being brought to faith in Jesus Christ by the power of the Holy Spirit. Did he continue to grapple with the truth honestly thereafter?
I think most people who have read Lewis are attracted to him in part because he grappled with the truth. He was a powerful writer, trained in English, and a lot of people with that kind of a background are really, really good writers. Jean Edward Veith is an example that should be familiar to a lot of your listeners. But he was an excellent writer who could combine both the logical, rational side of the brain with the imaginative and creative side of the brain. He brought those two together, but he was also very, very honest, so much so that he would admit the downside of some of his arguments as well as the upside. So, for example, he once said that no doctrine of the Christian faith has, this is a paraphrase, not an exact quotation, but he says, no doctrine of the Christian faith has seemed so weak to me than right after I have just successfully defended it. So when he's trying to defend it, it seems kind of weak to him at that time, as perhaps because he sees some of the flaws in his presentation. But then he goes on to admit there were also times when I was an atheist when I had to admit that the Christian message seemed also very attractive and very possibly true. So he can look at both sides of an issue, it seems to me, which is a very admirable quality, something that not many of us are capable of doing, and certainly not too many people in our country today are able to hear both sides of the story. We seem to be more polarized than we've ever been, at least at any point in my lifetime in this country.
You also write that it was his desire for autonomy, which you've spoken of many times here, the ability to be master of one's own fate, which was not only central to his adoption of atheism, but was also one of the reasons for his return to the Christian faith. How is that with about a minute or so?
Well, his own autonomy was central to his return to the Christian faith. I think partly because he realized that it was one-on-one between him and God now. And autonomy is overblown, so to speak, because everybody is really subject to some other authority, no matter who it is. Even the most powerful person in the world today, the President of the United States, is still subject to the three branches of government. He's only the head of one of the three branches. He's also married to a wife who has certain things to say, and he's subject to the God who made us. So even anybody that you might name today is subject to other authorities in spite of the fact that they have a certain amount of personal autonomy. And I think he realized that, and he realized that he hadn't done a really good job of his own autonomy and independence. He saw inside of himself what he once referred to as a zoo of lusts. When he became real honest about who he was and what he had done and how he treated his father, for instance, he became much more introspective and aware of his personal failings. And when, as long as evil is out there and it's resident in some system or some other person or group, we don't see the need of addressing it ourselves. But when it comes home personally, as it did with the death of his father, the illness and death of his father, in the light of how he had treated him, then it became much, much more personal, and it spoke much more specifically to him, which is, in a sense, what a really good preacher does when he proclaims the message of the law, not so much in generic terms, all of sin and fall short of the glory of God, a great passage in the book of Romans, but when we talk about some of the specific ways in which we have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And that's what I think God was doing with these last few years prior to his adoption of theism, helping Lewis to become aware that evil was resident in his own human heart. In fact, after he wrote the Screwtape letters, he was praised for having such a tremendous knowledge of human psychology. And his comment was that he really didn't know anything about psychology, but he had a huge advantage in that he could simply look inside himself and see how Satan had tempted him to sin and understand the ways in which Satan goes about tempting us to sin and writing those Screwtape letters, which are an imaginative collection of 31 letters from a senior devil to a junior devil on the art of temptation. he could write about the problem of sin because he had lived it himself.
Dr. Joel Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, visiting professor at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Canada, and author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, From Atheism to Christianity, the Story of C.S. Lewis. Next time he'll join us to talk about Lewis as a Christian. Dr. Heck, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're very welcome.
Aaron Wolf is our guest on the other side of the break. We're going to spend some time talking with him about freedom of speech and liberalism. Why is it the conservatives are now longing for an old school liberal freedom of speech? And I guess the most important question is, should they? Aaron Wolf will answer that question right after this.
Silicon Valley is a place of cutting-edge innovation which radically changes lives, where science fiction is already in research and development. In the heart of this digital chaos is a sanctuary of constancy and reverence, Hope Lutheran in Fremont, where nothing is new under the California sun, where the timeless gospel is proclaimed and the sacrament is celebrated with the historic liturgy that truly changes lives. And thanks to Silicon Valley, you may find us on the web at hopelutheranfremont.org.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Parents, you know the church is persecuted even when you don't feel it or see it. But how can you prepare your children for a post-Christian world where that persecution is increasingly obvious? Read the May issue of The Lutheran Witness to learn more about catechesis, persecution, and why it's your job, not your pastor's, to train your children in the faith. Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness for a special offer. $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Christian faith is a gift of God's grace. The Christian life is a gift of God's grace. We live by faith in the Son of God who loved us and gave himself for us.
Pastor Peter Bender talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And that means that our Lutheran piety is also a gift. All too often we see it as another work of the law, something that we must do. Instead, Christ meets us there with his word and spirit, and in our daily devotional life he teaches us what it is to live by faith in the Son of God who loved us and gave himself for us.
You can meet and hear Pastor Peter Bender making the case for Lutheran piety Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June 10th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.